Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the Nishit Desai Associates webinar on A New Dawn for Privacy in India, the Personal Data Protection Bill 2019. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference, please signal an operator by pressing star, then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mrs. Gauri Gokhale. Thank you, and over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, and good afternoon and good evening to all the participants on the call. Thanks for joining at such a short notice. We really appreciate you joining us. I think this data protection bill, has been in the offing for a while now. We did see its avatar, earlier in a 2018 version, which was heavily discussed, debated, at various forums. In fact, our firm also did have a couple of webinars discussing that particular, that particular bill. It's like a deja vu for us because we will be discussing some of the similar issues that we discussed earlier, but probably for refreshing everybody's memory. Today, I have with me my colleagues, Huzaifa, who heads our Bangalore office. Then we have Jaideep and Aaron, who are senior members and leaders of our technology team, both also focus on the data protection law. What we try to do today is, I think most of you must have already seen the 2018 and 2019 version of the Act. So we will avoid dealing with some of the nitty-gritties of the provisions, and the reason being that, as you all know, this particular bill is not as if it is going to be the law immediately. It will now undergo a parliamentary process. For those of you who may not be aware, this bill is now being sent to the Joint Parliamentary Committee, meaning thereby the members of Lok Sabha as well as members of Rajya Sabha, that are the upper and the lower houses of the parliament, are going to sort of look into this particular law in greater detail. They may independently have a consultation process. And they have been asked to give their views to the parliament, early next year. So the next session that we will have, say, in February to 2020, that is the time there is a likelihood that this, this particular bill, with certain amendments suggested by the Joint Parliamentary Committee, that they are likely to put forth again before the parliament. Once it is put before the parliament, then, of course, both the houses of the parliament will have to sort of approve the bill. The bill may be approved with further amendments as may be suggested on the floor of the house. And thereafter, of course, it will go to the President of India for the final confirmation. Having said that, it is very important for us to understand that the bill or the act, once it comes into effect, by itself against is not the complete law. The Data Protection Authority that has been will be constituted under the Act, and of course the central government also will have the ability to have what we call as delegated legislation. That means, there will be certain rules and codes of practices independently issued, which will determine the further implementation of the Act on various facets. Now, why is it important for us to understand this? Is because what will happen is, there are certain provisions, and if some of you may want to examine this in detail, there is a concept what we call as excessive delegation. That means if there are certain provisions of the Act which are allowing the authorities to determine certain facets by issuing codes of practices or rules, and if there is not enough guidance provided on what basis that determination needs to be done, then it could be viewed as excessive delegation, and on that ground itself, the law could be struck down, right? So that's the reason it is very important, and we have seen that in the past happening as well. So when, as a next step, I think all the industry members should carefully review as to which are the things that will be determined through the rules, which are the things that will be determined through the codes of practices, and effectively work as a group to sort of come up with their own thought process around it, And if there is a belief that, you know, certain things have to be looked into differently, the relevant recommendations could be made to the government. On this particular point, what we also intend to do today is for each section that we will take or each subject that we will take, we will point out which are the areas where further deliberation is required, which are the areas where they are vague. And as you may be aware, when a law is vague and it could be viewed as arbitrary and therefore again not valid, right? So which are those areas which all of us need to make further, you know, recommendations to the government and need to sort of smoothen the complete, you know, sort of drafting of the act? Because the last thing that we want is the uncertainty, right? Because uncertainty, I don't believe the industry has issues if, you know, there are compliances, okay, if this is a notice clause, issue notice, etc., etc. But the last thing that the industry wants is uncertainty, because uncertainty leads to, you know, identifying the risks involved, etc., etc. So I think that is the purpose of this discussion as well, to sort of initiate a dialogue with all of you to identify the areas where further representations could be made to the government. So the way probably to look at this is, you know, what we will do is we'll take each section and probably as a panel, we will have some dialogue, you know, amongst us for you to understand various facets of that. So I think what I'll do is, you know, I'll start with Aaron, mainly focusing on the, you know, on the applicability, right? And your also, you know, your views. The reason sort of I want you to look at this is, you know, our experience, for example, with a 2011, you know, sensitive personal data and information rules that were implemented under the Information Technology Act, our experience suggests that, you know, honestly, even today, the Indian industry is not in compliance with that, right? So in the context of that, you know, let us examine what is the current proposed applicability, yeah, and how we believe that it is so wide and encompassing, and, you know, your views and maybe a comment or two from others. Yeah.
Sure. Thank you, Gauri, for the introduction. So in terms of the applicability, you know, as Gauri mentioned, it's a completely revamped framework which is contemplated here. And, you know, when we look at the existing state of the 2011 rules and the state of compliance, this is definitely many steps ahead in terms of applicability on various fronts, right? A, in terms of applicability and who it applies to, B, in terms of territorial nexus, and three, in the types of data that is actually covered under the law. So just taking, you know, each of these 3 points or so, in terms of who the law applies to, unlike the existing law of the land, which applies, you know, to private entities, the new law also applies to state entities, to the state, the government agencies, as well as private parties. So it is a horizontal application. In terms of the person's data in question, similar to existing law, and actually very similar to laws of various worldwide jurisdictions, there is no distinction between foreign citizen data and Indian citizen data. There is one distinction which I'll talk about in a minute, but overall, in terms of the way it is defined, in terms of the applicable compliances, in terms of security and accountability safeguards, there's no distinction. So as such, everyone's data is treated on par in terms of applicability. The one exemption which I was referring to is, so India is known for being an outsourcing hub and has a lot of data processors, and it's the BPO, BPM outsourcing industry is very big, and India is known for that. One particular point to note here is that the government has the power to exempt certain data processors in India when processing data of foreign citizens or foreign entities. In this case, a special permission is required, and then such data processors in India would be exempt from various compliances under the Act. So this is one relaxation in terms of outsourcing activities, but that's again left to be seen on a case-to-case scenario where an approval is required. In terms of who the law applies to, the law applies to data fiduciaries, which is akin to data controllers. I won't spend too much time explaining what that is. It's very similar to data controllers, how it's known in most jurisdictions worldwide, including the GDPR, and of course data processors, which continues to be a similar concept. In terms of territorial nexus, and this is, and interestingly enough, this differs vastly from existing compliances in India. The law applies to both entities in India and foreign entity subject to a nexus. Now, when does the law apply to within India? It applies in two cases: when the processing or the collection or the storage occurs in India, and where the processing is carried out by an Indian entity or by the state itself. So that is fairly simple in terms of territorial applicability in India. Now, the more interesting part is the extraterritorial nexus of the law. And again, this is probably where certain flavors of the GDPR inspired the framing of this law, is that the law has extraterritorial application and applies to entities which fulfill a certain nexus. This includes where a business is carried on in India by a foreign entity, where there is or where there is a systematic activity of offering goods or services in India, or certain other activities which include profiling of Indian individuals. So either of these three would satisfy a certain nexus test. One point which we can deliberate on is where, so systematic activity of providing goods or services is fairly straightforward. There's a certain definition as to what systematic constitutes. Profiling as well seems to be a straightforward activity, but where certain deliberation could be done is carrying on business in India. And there seems to be some ambiguity in what constitutes carrying on business in India to trigger the applicability of the bill. Just to give you some context here, for example, the Australian data protection law clarifies what carrying on business, and it defines it as a repetitive and a continuous targeting of individuals with an intent of making profit. So it gives a certain explanation and definition to the meaning, which we don't have right now. So that's something which more clarity could be given on. In terms of data, and I won't spend time on the categories of data because my colleagues Jaideep and Huzaifa will talk about the different categories of data, because it is heavily linked to compliances and to cross-border data transfers and what's actually required. Broadly, three categories: personal data, that includes sensitive personal data, as well as critical personal data. There's also a concept of anonymized data, which is actually new in the version of the bill that just came out as opposed to last year. The law does not apply to processing of anonymized data. Anonymized data is defined as data which goes through anonymization, which is an irreversible process. And Gauri can explain more on this later on in the session. But there's a lot of worldwide debate on whether anonymization as a technology process is actually irreversible, right? So these are the kind of issues that, you know, will come up later in this webinar session. In terms of exemptions, I'll spend one last minute on who the law does not apply to or will not apply to. The law is primarily a digitally driven law, but it does apply to manual processing. So it applies to automated digital processing as well as manual processing. There is a small exemption which is carved out for manual processing by small entities. There's no clarity today, and it is largely left to the government to decide who the small entities are based on turnover of the entity, based on the kind of volume of the data that is processed by the entity. Mm-hmm. That's something we can wait for further clarity on in the codes of practice and by the regulator itself. A new concept also introduced as an exemption from the applicability of the law is a sandbox. Now, in the last year or two, if you've been following, you know, our updates and our discussions, we've been talking about sandboxes by various regulators, by the insurance regulator, the Securities and Exchange Board of India, and very recently the regulatory sandbox greenlit by the RBI, which is starting for retail payments early next year. So this is something which we would need to see whether it conflicts and how it's independently run. Just a couple of highlights from the sandbox provision is that the exemptions which are provided, so based on certain eligibility criteria, which would be, again, governed by the regulator, like most operational points, these kind of entities would be exempt from the applicability of certain compliances, like your notice requirement, as well as certain restrictions on accountability and security measures, which is a big compliance. So there would be a relaxation. Of course, there's no such concept of zero liability. There would still be certain penalties which would be prescribed by the regulator to such entities that avail of the sandbox. So this is an overall bird's eye view of the applicability on various fronts. Gauri, back to you.
Yeah, thanks. I think a couple of, you know, quick comments from my side on three points that you mentioned. I think on anonymization, just as a clarity, we did have that, you know, provision as such on anonymization, but how the there is an interesting provision on non-personal data, which I'll deal with later. Second, the point that you made, you know, valid point, you know, this law assumes that as between the data fiduciary and the data principal, we will always have a digital relationship. Because if you really see, you know, from a compliance perspective, which, you know, Jaideep will deal with, but what strikes me is that in the Indian context, it's, of course, we are digitizing and all of, you know, I mean, we are seeing the, you know, the digital penetration and all that. But so many of the relationship may not be digital relationships. Yeah. And then a compliance that you mentioned, you know, as a point. And interestingly, the sandbox point that you mentioned, I think one interesting thing is they say that, you know, what are the penalties in so far as non-compliance of the some of the provisions that have been agreed. But I don't think they have clarified that once you're in the sandbox, and I think they should, once you're in the sandbox, none of the other penalty provisions should apply. Whatever the penalty provisions that have been prescribed for the sandbox, only those provisions should apply, and all the other penalty provisions which, you know, which we will discuss, those should not apply. I think if these two things are clarified, I think, you know, it's as such a good sort of, I mean, I think overall a good approach. I think what we will now do is, you know, Jaideep, with you, it may be useful to focus, you know, on the areas of compliance, because as we have discussed, this law is heavily compliance driven. One argument always being made is that, hey, you know, people have complied with GDPR, you know, then what's the problem of compliance of this in India? Of course, you know, in the Indian context, we have seen that we have not really seen a good compliance on 2011 rules itself. So that's a separate point. But from your perspective, what are the key issues in the compliance context, and probably, you know, some of the issues such as, you know, the consent manager, which is a new concept, children's data, how is it going to be handled? So if you can just give us some key takeaways for us to deliberate further.
Sure. So thanks, Gauri. And I think Aaron's introduction sets a good tone on to whom this law applies. Once it's determined that a particular entity falls under the scope of the law, the first question they would have is what they need to do. And just to set the tone, there are two or three different categorizations that we need to keep in mind throughout the compliance discussion. One is the type of data that's being collected. There is the concept of personal data, which is central to the law, in fact, finds its place in the title of the law. But there are two important subsets of personal data, which are sensitive personal data and critical personal data. So mere personal data, which doesn't amount to the other two, is currently at the lower end of the compliance spectrum, followed by sensitive personal data and critical personal data, which is at the highest end. Some of you may have read that critical personal data must be stored only in India. My colleague Utefa will deal with the storage requirements in due course. The second categorization to be kept in mind is the type of entity. Aaron mentioned that we would have data fiduciaries, data processors, which are akin to the EU style of categorization. We would also have a new category called significant data fiduciaries. So in ascending order of the compliance burden, we have data processors, followed by data fiduciaries, and followed by significant data fiduciaries who are at the highest end of the compliance spectrum and should definitely begin preparing to implement some of the processes set out in the bill, because they're quite detailed. Coming to the actual obligations themselves, largely, the principles are similar to other omnibus privacy laws such as the GDPR and the newly introduced California Consumer Privacy Law. They follow the principles of notice, consent, purpose limitation, storage limitation, data minimization. So we're not going into those in detail because largely global organizations are familiar with those principles. The important thread that this bill draws is that there are two large heads of processing, consent and non-consent. So the the base rule is that there should always be consent from the data principal, who is the individual, and the consent has to be explicit, and there are certain grounds laid down as to what consent would amount to, which we're not going into in detail. So organizations obviously need to implement processes to inform individuals and obtain the necessary standard of consent from them. Importantly, there are certain grounds where data can be processed even without consent. And that's something worth discussing, and that's something that people may be interested in. One of the significant grounds is for employment-related purposes. For example, for the recruitment or termination of an employee, as long as it's personal data, which doesn't amount to SPD or sensitive personal data, there is a possibility to process that data without consent, given certain other requirements are met, such as there's no, it's quite difficult to obtain consent. There are certain provisos and conditionalities laid down. But largely, there is a possibility to process the data even without consent in an employment context. The second important non-consent permission is something called reasonable purposes. Now, as of now, we don't have clarity on what a reasonable purpose is. It's something that the central government would lay down by way of rules. But there are guidance. There is guidance in the section on what basis the central government can specify a reasonable purpose. So just to stretch the, just to go to the sequitur of that point, if something is a reasonable purpose, then the data fiduciary or processor doesn't have to obtain consent of the individual. And largely the reasonable purpose is based on what is another concept introduced in the bill called reasonable expectation of the individual. So largely it's aiming to be a fair law based on the principles of fairness and reasonableness, that a data principal's data should not be processed in a manner that they would not expect. One interesting point that we were discussing among us is that say there is no consent obtained from an individual, but there is a contract entered into with the individual. Would that come under the purview of reasonable purpose? Because the data principal may reasonably expect that this entity may process my data. That's an open question where, again, the industry can chip in and make its views heard on what kind of purposes they feel are reasonable, because there is discretion of the central government to notify those purposes. Another broad thread running through the bill, which is not a specific compliance obligation, is the overarching theme of fair and reasonable processing in a manner which respects the privacy of the individual and which meets the reasonable expectation of the individual and meets the context of the relationship. Now, this is something where it's inherently subjective. It may not need to be done away with, but it's something that people should note because it's inherently subjective, like our Articles 14 and 21, which are subject to interpretation and by nature maybe cannot be made specific. But the use of the words like fair and reasonable expectation, when seen in the light of the fact that individuals can claim compensation on breach of any provisions of the Act, leads to the question of whether there's going to be quite a bit of claims, compensation, litigation under the Act, because people will have varying understandings of what constitutes fair and reasonable processing, reasonable expectation, etc. As far as the processing of children's data goes, the broad thread, which is again in line with the global principles, is that there should be an age verification process and the parental consent or guardian consent should be obtained. That's something I think that many global organizations would be familiar with. But there is a new concept of guardian data fiduciary. which can be notified under the law based on whether the services are directed at children. Once somebody is a guardian data fiduciary, there are heightened obligations vis-a-vis children. So that's something that services which are focused towards children or process large volumes of children's data should bear in mind. Now, one more kind of headline-making topic which many of you may have read about is the social media intermediaries concept. This actually comes within a larger umbrella called significant data fiduciary, which is the most regulated entity under the law. Significant data fiduciaries would be notified by the regulator, which is the Data Protection Authority, based on the volume of data they process and the risk of harm to the individual. Once they are notified, they need to register themselves with the authority. So they become something like a regulated entity under the supervision of that authority. And once that is in place, there are a host of compliance obligations that they need to put processes in place for. These include something called a data protection impact assessment. Before they carry on any large-scale profiling, they need to carry out an impact assessment and not process the data if the authority finds that it's going to cause harm. They also need to carry out independent audits. So there will be a new class of professionals under the bill who are data auditors who will audit these data fiduciaries. They need to maintain records. They need to have a data protection officer. So they will become full-fledged regulated entities under this law. Social media intermediaries is a specific class of significant data fiduciaries. And if what constitutes a social media intermediary, largely the definition is in line with what we understand to be a vanilla social media platform. And if there is a particular user threshold and there is an impact on electoral matters and other matters of public interest, those social media intermediaries would amount to significant data fiduciaries, and therefore they become regulated entities to be registered with the authority, etc. One particular provision which one may argue whether it's within the scope of the data protection law or not is the concept of voluntary verification of users. So many of you would be familiar with the Twitter blue tick users who have the blue tick mark as verified users. This is something akin to that, where users can go to a platform and say they want to be verified. The consequence on data protection is not immediately clear. It appears to be more towards the authenticity of information and the traceability of users. But that's something, again, that no doubt will be a focus of discussion by the Joint Parliamentary Committee. Before I close this part, Gauri mentioned the concept of consent managers. That's a new concept introduced under the bill and seems to be a fairly innovative concept which doesn't find place in many of the other global frameworks. Consent managers are basically intermediaries between the individual and the data fiduciary, but interestingly, they themselves have been classified as a data fiduciary. So they will perform functions like communicating consent between individuals and fiduciaries. Whether they are data fiduciaries according to the definition is again a matter that can be taken up with the committee, because the way data fiduciary is defined is somebody who determines the purposes of the processing, whereas consent managers are probably just communicating information between the individual and the corporate or the government, and therefore acting more as middlemen or intermediaries rather than determining the purpose. But what it will lead to is a new class of professionals under this law, and we'll see that coming in. It will be interesting to see how that framework plays out, because it's a fairly innovative concept. You might find consent manager websites and people registering themselves with those websites, which can act as a one-stop shop for managing all their consents in one place.
Thanks, Jaideep, for that. I mean, very, very interesting, you know, sort of discussion that you are leading us to, because 2-3 takeaways for me is, first of all, I think, you know, the point about the notice and consent that you mentioned in the Indian context with, you know, so many languages that we have in India, I think the law also contemplates, you know, multi-language notices, right, which is going to be interesting to see as to how that will be sort of affected in the first place. Second, I think on the you know, on the compliances that you mentioned, I think I just want to reiterate this debate, especially in the Indian context, is whether all these compliances that you spoke about, whether, you know, they should be made applicable to the entire gamut of personal data. Because if you see the definition, you know, anything and everything can be construed as personal data, right? So whether that should be a revisiting to say that, okay, can we limit these provisions only to sensitive personal data or not? You know, that itself becomes a debate. I think the other, you know, issue in the context of the point that you mentioned about the verification, right? I think what is happening, and I will deal with that maybe, you know, later, you know, time permitting, but what we are seeing is there are, you know, so many issues in front of the government or courts or otherwise, and I think they are looking at this law as panacea for all. I think that's the way, you know, whether it is, you know, identification of the user, whether use of non-personal data, I think somewhere that urge to, you know, to try to do anything and everything within this act, I think should be curbed in my mind, and, you know, just focus only, you know, in terms of the protection of the data rather than anything else, right? I think that is my takeaway, at least, you know, from the discussion. I think the other interesting aspect which Aaron mentioned insofar as applicability to the foreign providers in India, but also in the context of sensitive personal data, you know, the transfer of sensitive personal data from India and the localization, right? I think these three issues were in the earlier version quite critical, and data localization, especially after what RBI did overnight, insofar as the financial data is concerned, the payments data is concerned, there was a huge apprehension about a mandatory data localization for all data sets in the Indian context, right? So over to you, Huzaifa, about your thoughts on how do we look at, you know, the slightly, so at least prima facie, diluted data localization requirements, but whether they are indeed diluted, you know, what is your take on that?
No, I think, no, thanks, Gauri, and thank you all for, I think, a context setting. Probably the way to look at it is, you know, in the 21st century and moving forward, you know, where the lines and boundaries are getting blurrer and blurrer. And especially when it comes to digital services and digital commerce, everything is one, right, from one country to the other. So specifically from that context, Indian individuals using foreign services or using, you know, availing of foreign goods, definitely there is some sort of sharing from India to overseas of data. The second situations, which are pretty common in this digital and today's e-com and internet world, is whereby Indian companies are also using a lot of foreign service providers to enhance their business. So in both cases, there is definitely some sort of data which goes outside India. And there are, you know, various industries which get tipped, whether it's fintech, health tech, med tech, cloud. You know, Gauri mentioned that there could be certain industry-specific laws, but that's a separate thing. But for the purpose of, you know, the data protection bill, at a pan-India level, the bill talks about a few things, right? One, it has already segregated the categories of data, which my colleagues have rightfully discussed. So if we break up the data into three sets, one is personal data, the mother set, and the two subcategories, which are sensitive personal data and critical personal data. So when it comes to data transfers, how does it actually, you know, apply to these three formats? I think that is critical. So if I break this down, when it is general personal data, not amounting to critical personal data or sensitive personal data, there are no statutory limitations for the data to be in India. To the extent, you know, relevant consents are taken and other relevant compliances in relation to obligations in relation to those consents are taken, personal data can be shared overseas, but that personal data is not amounting to critical personal data or sensitive personal data. So that's the simpler one. Let's look at the other two, which get more interesting. So when it is critical personal data, there is an absolute data localization requirement, which basically says that the data should be processed only in India, which means to a large extent, you know, inherently everything needs to stay in India. As my colleagues, you know, earlier said that critical personal data is something which is not yet determined or identified. It's going to come over a period of time. There's only one exception, probably two exceptions in relation to when critical personal data can be transferred overseas. One, of course, there is a health service or an emergency service which is necessary. And second, you know, if the central government deems fit in relation to the recipient or the receiving entity or the overseas country where the data is going to be transferred, it does not affect the security and interest of the state, then that's fine. But largely, to sum it up, when it comes to critical personal data, there is an absolute data localization barring these two scenarios. Now comes the more interesting part, which is a slightly broader data set, which is sensitive personal data, and my colleagues have spoken what sensitive personal data would amount to. The question is that can it be transferred outside India, and if yes, what are the requirements? So I'll talk about, you know, both these situations. So the good part is that when it comes to sensitive personal data, it can be transferred outside India. So the law does permit you to transfer it outside India, but it's subject to three you know, key compliances. One, it has to be continued to be stored in India. So there comes our data localization requirement for sensitive personal data, but it's not an absolute data localization requirement. You can transfer it for the legitimate business purposes, but you continue to store it in India. That is one. Second, you know, which is of course the overarching principle of the law, in and rightfully so, that the data principal needs to explicitly consent to that transfer, which is fair, right? You need the consent when you're transferring it. Now comes the most interesting part, which is the third part. So look at the situation where the foreign processor or the India data fiduciary, while transferring, is one, continue to store it in India, second, has obtained explicit consent. After these two have been validly undertaken, the third is that you still cannot transfer it till, you know, it is somewhere blessed by the data protection authority. And I'll probably explain this further. In the last obligation, whether transfer is actually happening through a contract or you're transferring the data through a third party foreign country, or you're transferring a data to a recipient in a foreign company, or the data is part of the intergroup transfers, you know, among multinationals. In all these cases, the data protection authority actually needs to approve this transfer. So the data protection authority will, you know, kind of approve the recipient or the entity or the scheme. So the broader principle to this is that when SPD is being transferred, it has to be subject to approval by the data protection authority. Having said that, amongst all of this, there is one critical question which remains unanswered, and probably this is where some clarity from the legislators would be very helpful, that what do you mean by transfer? So there could be two situations which would arise, right? There could be a situation where the data fiduciary is an overseas company and the data principal is in India, and the data principal is directly sharing the data with the data fiduciary. In those sort of situations, would it amount to transfer? And if it does, would all these compliances get triggered? That is one. Or would it actually apply in cases where there is a data fiduciary in India who's collecting data from the data principal, and part of rendering services, he's using a foreign data processor, and that is where transfer in that context needs to be looked at. So there are these two, you know, key situations which would arise, and it is very helpful, you know, some sort of clarity in relation to this particular aspect, because it will only help compliances by Indian companies, by foreign companies to abide by the spirit of the law. And of course, the third category, which is an interesting category, which means that the Act also applies where processing happens in India by Indian companies of data of foreign nationals. Of course, there are going to be certain exemptions where the mechanism is there in terms of what can be exempted or what not can be exempted. But currently, pure play, when a foreign national data is being processed by an Indian company in India, the Act applies, the data also needs to go back. So the question remains that whether that would also amount to transfer and whether the do's and don'ts under the transfer provisions for SPD would apply. So I think the step is in the right direction, but there is some clarity which would be helpful specifically surrounding these points, and I'm sure with the passage of time and before implementation, these things would get answered.
Thanks, Huzaifa. A couple of observations here based on what you said, my take on it. So I think the most important part that you mentioned in the end, right? What does Indian government want? Do they want that sensitive personal data which is being processed of the world that needs to be stored in India? I don't think that is the intent, right? So I think both for sensitive personal data from a storage perspective and critical personal data, I believe it has to be clarified that it is the residents of India or citizens of India or whatever. From overall processing, yes, the law can apply to the foreign citizens, but at least for the localization purpose, in my mind, we don't need to want to call it localization, but anyway, if we want to call use that word, I think it is very, very important to clarify that position, because otherwise it's like foreign data coming to India, sensitive data processing, obviously, I think they have given some exemptions for processing, but that overall reading together is not very clear today. That can be clarified. Number two, the point of, let us understand, earlier they were talking about the entire data to be localized, right? Of course, the processing can happen, broader data set. But today, when you talk about sensitive personal data only requiring to be sort of also stored in India, in my mind, when you have mixed data sets, and if you see it may sound very funny, but if you really see that, if you see the definition of sensitive personal data, it includes caste and religion. Now, if you see in the Indian context, my surname tells you that, right? So that means that all the data sets essentially may be viewed as sensitive data sets, right? Which are tagged to my data set. So is there any really distinction that can be made? So first, going back to the definition itself, whether, there has to be a carve out of the surname in the first place from the caste and religion, that's my question. The other one is when you have a mixed data set, honestly, this doesn't really help that the broader data set is not required to be kept. So in my mind, like for example, financial services companies, as well as the healthcare pharma companies, I think these are the ones who definitely will get caught in this. Financial services, I think I'm slightly digressing, but important to make a note here. In the earlier consultation process, I think the financial services had made a request that the definition is very wide of financial services. And maybe, some of you who are interested, maybe that's a side discussion that we can have at a later point in time, but I just want to leave this with you that there was a good amount of representation made. I was a part of few roundtables here in Mumbai where financial services industry was sitting together and making that recommendation that you limit the definition, because otherwise that's the other issue, because especially in the context of fraud detection worldwide, etc., it is important for them to have that complete understanding of this ecosystem or assessment or analytics of the financial data, and therefore the transfer outside India becomes relevant, right? So I know there is no prohibition as such, luckily, for the transfer now, but there are compliances one has to undertake. Okay, now moving on to the next point, I think more from our data, as all of us are data principles as well. So what rights do we have, Aaron, and do you think you are going to ever exercise those rights?
Sure. Thanks, Gauri. So, just to give you a 10-second nutshell, the new law, the proposed law, is primarily a consumer-based law and focuses on rights conferred on individuals, right? Our existing law from 2011 is very basic and is primarily notice and consent-based with very minimal compliances which are applicable. But here we find that the new law proposed is a rights-based approach in terms of various provisions and rights conferred on data subjects or data principles. Now, I want to focus on four major rights, and I don't think I need to spend too much time because these are more or less standard compliances. I will try and bring out one or two interesting points under each of them, but they are primarily similar to various US and GDPR provisions on the same subject. The first one is an individual, the data subject has the right to confirmation and access of the data. What does this mean? An individual can request a data fiduciary, any entity holding their data, on what data has actually been processed, what is the processing that has happened. One interesting point here is that the fiduciary has to provide the individual a summary of the processing activities. Hmm. Now, it says there's a little bit of ambiguity here on how detailed it needs to be, who are the stakeholders, whether they need to be mentioned in the summary. But this is something that organizations would need to implement at an operational level on kind of a format, right, on how they want to give this kind of information to users upon request. The second one is on the right to correct and erase data. Now, this is an interesting point because we've, and even today, we have the right to correct data in the existing law, but nowhere in the existing law or even various sector-wise regulations which have provisions on data, is there a positive right given to have data deleted or erased? So this is the first of its type, which has been introduced in India. Now, how this would work is that an individual may exercise the right to correct the data, complete the data, update the data, or have the data erased. Now, an interesting point here is that the individual may, in his or her own discretion or determination, request for deletion of the data. So it's not necessary that certain objective targets have to be met. If the individual is of the opinion that the data is no longer needed or the purpose has been served, then a request may be made. Now, this is uncertain because an organization may still need the data for certain internal or back-end processes, right? So there is a very small adjudicatory process in terms of back and forth between the data subject and the entity, but how this is finally resolved is unknown, and this may lead to some kind of conflict. But this is something that's important on the right to request erasure of the data. On data portability,
may I just stop you here and make a comment, you know, so that I don't forget. I think when we were again doing a lot of industry consultation, it interestingly came up whether, you know, one can say that the data has been erased. In the digital footprint, you know, whether one can actually certify that the data has in fact been fully erased, you know, that itself is something technologically one has to, you know, examine. Yeah, go ahead.
Absolutely. The next one I want to focus on is data portability. Data portability is essentially the right to have the data transferred either back to the individual or to another entity. Now, it's very similar again to the GDPR. One or two pain points that you know, may be experienced here is that upon request by an individual, the data fiduciary has to provide to the data to the individual or to a third party entity certain data. Now, this data which needs to be transferred back to the individual or to another third party includes data which is provided, which overall seems fine, but it also includes data which is generated by the data fiduciary in the course of providing services or which forms part of the profile of the user or which is otherwise obtained. Now, do these two, three types of data is typically not something submitted by a user, but is something which is generated, derived at, and compiled by the fiduciary based on various analytics processes and internal know-how of the organization in making a profile of a particular user. It could be of an e-commerce platform, it could be on any online service. It could help in targeted advertisements. It could help in product selections, which could be shown to a user. This is how essentially user profiles are made. The problem here is that there is a carve out and a transfer of this over, let's call it a data set here for the purpose of this limited discussion. The carve out where a data set need not be transferred to the individual or maybe to another data fiduciary, which could be a rival of the data fiduciary in question, is where it relates to a trade secret being exposed. But this exemption, we feel, is not, may not be wide enough If a data set is transferred, for instance, by one e-commerce player to another, there may be scope that certain reverse engineering may take place, certain technology process may be implemented to arrive at how the profile of the user was made. And this may lead to certain exposing of a company's IP, right, which may be shared with other entities in the market. The last one I'll just spend 30 seconds on is the right to be forgotten. Now, this is, unlike the GDPR, actually, is a very limited right and is subject to an order by an adjudicatory officer. So it's not a right that one can just exercise. It's subject to an order being passed.
Mm.
Now, there may be three circumstances where this right may be exercised. That is where the purpose for collection or processing of the data has been served, where consent has been withdrawn, or when certain disclosures are made in violation to certain provisions of the Act. Now, a user, a data subject may make a request, and in the request, the main point that needs to be put forward to the adjudicatory officer to rule in favor of is that the individual has to show that the right to prevent a continuing disclosure overrides the freedom of speech and expression and the right to information of the public at large. So overall, it has to be proved that the individual's right is bigger than the society's right. So these are some of the major rights and certain pinpoints under each of them.
Sure.
Back to you, Bari.
Yeah, a couple of comments. So I think, you know, very, very important is that I think, you know, whenever I see, you know, some of the things that we have done in our law, which almost mimics probably what has been done in GDPR, I'm wondering whether, you know, somebody has actually seen as to the real benefits, if any, derived, you know, under the GDPR regime. Has anybody studied the pain points being exercised? Because sometimes there are provisions that you sort of, you know, try to include with a particular purpose in mind, whether that purpose in fact is being served or is there any mischief being created by that, right? So I think it's important for some of these provisions to study, in fact, what has happened, you know, in the GDPR regime. It's particularly the point of portability. I can clearly understand, for example, you know, my credit history, my medical history, right? I want to sort of go move to a separate service provider and then, you know, sort of avail. Versus I'm doing a, you know, transaction on one e-commerce platform and the other e-commerce platform and me requiring to transfer my history, you know, what is the purpose to be served here really, right? So I think some of these things in the Indian context, whether there is a need to identify is that particular, you know, sort of box or create walls within that to say, okay, for these purposes, that a data portability could be asked for or determination of a purpose, right? So that's the other piece I wanted to discuss, I mean, sort of for want the industry to deliberate. And I think from a right of erasure versus forgotten, that the difference sometimes is missed out. That erasure being, you know, within my system, right, to be forgotten being, you know, my information being available in the public domain and then, you know, sort of removing access to that kind of public domain information, right? So I think some of these elements we definitely evaluate, you know, to have that. Is it something which will merely become more like a, you know, kind of a irritant rather than serving the real purpose for which it is being provided. I think the other important aspect which a lot of civil societies have debated over and over again is how is state being treated under the Act, right? Because the worry, and right from the privacy judgment, we have seen that the Supreme Court also, you know, has specifically said that any access that the state requires from the private bodies to the information of the citizens has to be, you know, keeping in mind the privacy right, correct? So you need to sort of satisfy the thresholds laid down for the disclosure under, you know, various regimes. And even, you know, the phone tapping case, etc., that we have seen in the past, you know. So just to sort of, before I hand it over to Huzaifa, you know, there has been, as I said, multiple issues that probably all the, you know, countries are facing in so far as, you know, requiring access to data, say, for purpose of your investigation, security, et cetera, versus the privacy, right? And even in the Aadhaar case, what they started by saying that, you know, only on the assumption that something is going to go wrong. I mean, I'm putting it very, very blunt, simply here, but only on the assumption, you know, like you're putting everybody on the same page, you know, that everybody is a criminal, start with that premise and therefore need access to their data, right? So that's the mindset against which, you know, the Aadhaar judgment essentially came out, right? So over to you, Huzaifa, as to does the bill, you know, does it have exemptions which are overarching exemptions in the hands of state? Is there something that needs to be revisited in the context of the privacy judgment or the Aadhaar judgment that we have seen? And, you know, I'm sure, you know, civil societies will do their duty in terms of bringing all these out before the joint parliamentary committee.
No, I think that's a brilliant layup, Gauri, and it's actually poised at a very interesting time because at one side, the highest court of India has recognized privacy as a fundamental right. So, you know, the pedestal has been put. And specifically on this point, there have been various news reports reporting in terms of, you know, the overarching rights which the government are seeking to obtain under this law. But the point is, what is being obtained or what is being exempted under this particular law? The particular exemption which the government, is seeking under this particular law is that it can exempt the applicability of any provisions of the Act to any government agency for the processing of data if it is, in the interest of sovereignty and integrity of India, or it's in relation to preventing incitement to violence or to safeguard public order, then the central government can actually exempt certain or all of the provisions of the Act. Having said that, this is the most important line, in relation to this under the bill. It says that when a particular agency is exempt from these sort of provisions, the same would also and at all times be subject to adequate safeguards and oversight mechanisms which need to be followed by the agency. So though the central government has a particular regime in the proposed bill whereby there can be certain exemptions or all, this is the provision of the Act, but the agencies to which these exemptions apply will still need to follow the necessary safeguard and oversight mechanisms as may be prescribed. So there seems to be some sort of a maker-checker or a balance which is sought to be achieved vis-a-vis the exemptions. But more importantly, before jumping the gun, I think we will need to wait and watch and see what are these safeguards and oversight mechanisms which would be prescribed. And I think the more important part is that the safeguard and oversight mechanisms which need to come in or which will come in need to look at privacy from a broader perspective, especially considering, it has been recognized as a fundamental right and the entire purpose should not be trivialized. I think to that extent, if, a certain balance is achieved, it will be good. And this is something which is also present in a lot of other laws in India whereby the state has the rights to, step in such scenarios. There is another exemption which is also there. This was specifically in relation to central government agencies. In addition to that, there are also certain provisions of the Act which get exempted, specifically when it comes to law and enforcement agencies, when they're undertaking some sort of investigations or, evaluating any contraventions under law. There are certain exemptions of certain provisions of the Act, specifically, during the prosecution or defending any legal action or legal proceedings for the purpose of journalistic purposes, there's an exemption. So there are also certain other exemptions whereby a lot of provisions of these laws have been exempted and some provisions need to apply. We would just need to evaluate this further, specifically in relation to these specific exemptions which I just mentioned, whether it actually makes sense to extend the proposed safeguards and oversight mechanisms in such scenarios. But having said that, just to reiterate, these exemptions which I'm talking about are exemptions under the Act. It does not dilute provisions of other laws. So for example, tomorrow if there is a certain interception which needs to happen of any digital platforms or online sites, the procedures, say, for example, under the Information Technology Act would need to be followed. So the independent statute acts and procedures which are there, actions under those acts vis-a-vis the central government and authorities continue to be followed. This particular exemption is only in relation to the provisions of this act, not the other acts. I think, yeah. Over to you, Gauri.
Sure. I think that's an interesting thing, and we'll really need to see because there is a lot of, sort of concern about state having unbridled access to the, to the personal data, and whether or not, enough has been done in this regard. And what worries me also is this overriding provision under Section 96, which says that save as otherwise provided in this Act, the provisions of this Act shall have effect notwithstanding anything, inconsistent therewith in any other law for the time being in force. Or any instrument having effect of et cetera, right? So I think my worry is that something should not be done under this Act, which sort of overrides all the other, balancing activities that you mentioned or balancing acts that are available in the other laws, right? So I think that's one thing, sometimes you miss out sometimes the innocuous provision here and there, and, how the interplay with the other laws, sometimes may be missed out. And we see then that being litigated at a later point in time, right? So I think that's going to be very, very important. I know we are just, couple of 5 minutes, maybe more, then we need to open for question answers. But I think couple of quick points we may want to spend, because these are important points, is an authority has been created under the Act called Data Protection Authority. And then it has been given certain powers. So we will not deal so much with the powers. But I think I would request Jaideep to very, very briefly touch upon the financial penalties, not so much on the quantum and this and that, but overarching, providing whether, because there was an apprehension that, there are criminal liabilities getting created under the Act in the earlier version, right? I think to that has been diluted. So why don't you just clarify what type of actions are we going to probably see under this? There are two bodies, DPA, Appellate Authority, Supreme Court, by that order in terms of appeal. So could you just quickly spend a couple of minutes there?
Sure. So this is going to be a fully streamlined regulatory process akin to something we are familiar with other regulators like SEBI, TRAI, etc. So there's a specialized regulator called the Data Protection Authority. It will have adjudicating officers. A parallel could be drawn with income tax adjudicating officers, and it will have there will be a separate appellate tribunal. So the regulator will supervise compliance under the Act. It may take action for violation under the Act, and there are penalties. The penalties are of fairly high quantum, up to 4% of global turnover in some cases. So there may be regulatory action on the one hand, in which case penalties and criminal liability could arise, though the criminal liability has been reduced compared to the earlier draft, and I think the industry would welcome that. So that is one track where the regulator itself initiates action and imposes sanctions. The second track is an important right of claiming compensation by the data principal. So that this could give rise to a whole new stream of litigation and claims before the authority and the tribunal, especially on the more subjective grounds. And we may see some case law and jurisprudence developing. So broadly, it arises out of sua motu action of the regulator or compensation claimed by individuals with criminal liability for certain narrow cases of violation.
Sure. So I think, because I think there is a parallel action. So suppose there is a breach. What I am understanding is if there is a breach, there will be a penalty that the authority can lay. In addition, there could be compensation if a data principal goes and raises a compensation claim, right? So in both, so for the same action, you could have penalty and compensation to be paid, right? I think whether and to what extent whether there will be parallel actions, right? Whether or not is it in the same action? I think that's something, you know, we need to examine as well, because we want to avoid definitely a multiplicity of proceedings. The other thing is, you know, in the context of the appellate authority, it says that, you know, appellate authority, you know, that's a final jurisdiction or otherwise, but of course there could be writs, you know, sometimes, you know, so a writ jurisdiction can never be necessarily negated. So even against the DPA's actions, there could be writs, right? So I think the more streamlined and a structured approach that the DPA adopts, for example, we noticed even the show cause notices, you know, by the current regulators are not adequate enough. Then you run to the writ court, right? So I think they should do a good job, if I to use a simple word, in terms of setting their processes which are foolproof in terms of, you know, adhering to principles of natural justice, adequate notice, you know, right to be heard, or whatever the processes that will be set up for any regulator or a quasi-judicial or, you know, tribunal. I think all those principles will have to be followed by that. Otherwise, you're going to have a mess of, you know, a flurry of writ petitions that we see for the other regulators. I think before we conclude, a quick note on Section 91, which essentially deals with the non-personal data. Non-personal data could be of two categories. Personal data, which is anonymized and therefore considered as a non-personal data, or a completely non-personal data, that means not relating to humans, for example, the weather data or the traffic data, right? So I think those categories of data, I think there was a separate committee that was set up, you know, probably a couple of months back for, and this theme is running through from your e-commerce policy draft, controversial, confidential e-commerce policy draft that was being circulated. I think the theme runs through to say that, hey, there is this so much data available out there, which is non-personal or anonymized. How can we better use that data for the betterment of the community, right? Whether it's the community data, who owns the data, you know, all those debates are running around. So I think what the law has done, this particular act has suddenly come up to say that, you know, there could be a policy where authority can direct a disclosure of certain non-personal data for the purpose of, you know, sort of rendering of, you know, essential services, delivery of services. I think I believe they talk about more, I think, subsidy and those type of services. I believe that's what they refer to, and evidence-based policy making. I think the debate on the non-personal data worldwide is still, you know, underway, including ownership, including access, including competition law issues and the like. In my mind, if you ask me my personal view, I would stay out of this, in the sense, take out 91 completely from this act. Let the committee do independent consultation, come out with, you know, stakeholder consultation, and then deal with that. Because you leave it here, it's going to create one more confusion, because whether the DPA is the right authority in the first place to deal with this non-personal data, we don't know, right? I think that's something, we in our mind, it's an open point to sort of debate. And therefore, at least if you are looking at this law being passed by February, if at all, I would stay out of, you know, keep this out. My last takeaways from this is industry still needs to, you know, pull up their stocks, still needs to do further consultation and, you know, with the government on several of the items that we spoke, and there could be many more, which I think we will shortly be circulating our update. I know it has taken some time, but this topic requires that amount of deliberation. So all of you will receive our update, and which will point out additional items as well. The law does not currently have the transition provisions that we saw before. That means we don't know how the law is going to be implemented. What we hear that the 2 years may be given to the industry. I hope so, because there's lots to be done before that. There will be rules and codes of practices that the industry needs to sort of start looking at, how they want to sort of take a proactive action on that. I think some of the things which are a done deal, for example, your notice and consent and all of that, some of those action items you already have an indication. I would urge that, you know, parties start looking at, you know, companies start looking at basically the complete data flow within their organizations and start putting their, you know, notice and consent together, because whether the act will be prospective or retrospective is not clear. What I mean thereby is, whether the data that I had collected before, if I have to continue to use it thereafter, do I need to sanitize that data by, you know, sort of doing my redoing my notices and consents as we saw on the GDPR, or I'm okay to continue to process that past data in the future without that requirement? You know, all these are still open questions, and the more clarity we get, the better, especially in the Indian context, for, you know, so many organizations have to comply with the law. The better clarity that the industry gets, the better implementation for all of us as data principals as well, right? So I'm going to stop here, and I think we have about 15 minutes for a question and answers. And if you are not able to answer all the questions on this call, we are happy to, you know, receive your emails as well, you know, separately. And as I said, in a couple of days, do await our update on the subject. Thank you. Thank you, all the speakers on this panel.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Shall we begin with the question and answer session?
Yes, please.
We'll now begin with the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask questions may press star and one on the touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking questions. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. To ask a question, please press star and one on your touchtone telephone. We have the first question from the line of Umang Soni from Crypto Exchange. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, the panelists and the moderator, for sharing such a wonderful and a very structured way the information about this upcoming data protection law in India. So I have categorically two questions, which is one with respect to consent manager. That is, that is the panelist, anyone of you can answer, is there a possibility of having a product with respect to consent manager where it's kind of a set of checklists, and then the organization will implement those checklists and automatically it will get implemented, or it will get recorded as per the explicit consent given by the user for their respective product and offering? This is one. And second question is with respect to data localization. So somebody can just more highlight more parts that how it will impact the overall law with respect to its implementation across organization. Thank you.
Sure. You want to take that question on consent manager, Jaideep, or you want
sure,
me to?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I'll take a crack and then you can add. So on consent manager, as of now, there are words like the consent manager can manage the consent, allowed the withdrawing of consent, etc. So one would imagine that what this means is they can also enable platform, which could be online or offline, to provide something like a dashboard. In fact, a different concept of consent dashboard was being discussed in some circles. The consent manager could enable the individual to give consent, withdraw consent, and maybe even tweak consent through an online platform, or say through offline agents where online is not feasible. Does that go to your question?
Yeah, I think let me add to that. I think how I see this is more like a gatekeeper. For example, suppose I have, say, three types of apps on my, you know, on my mobile. One is more to do with my financial management. Second one is my, say, data sort of content consumption. And the third being my, say, taxi service or something like that, right? So what will happen is I'm just sort of, again, this is a new concept. I'm just trying to sort of visualize it. So maybe the consent manager could be a platform business that you create to say that, hey, if you have a taxi aggregator app, you know, that you have on your mobile, which are three aggregators or any other that will come in, for the taxi aggregator app, these are the consents that are available. Which ones would you want to give, right? Like, for example, location is an important one, right? but you know, my home address may not be the relevant one, because where do I start is not a not the point of, you know, that is not an information required. So what I would do is, instead of going to each app separately and, you know, doing my consent, I would say taxi aggregators app, this type of consent, automatically that consent manager would manage those consents for me. But I think for this, I'm just trying to sort of think through, is that means there has to be an API integration or whatever between all the apps and, you know, all the fiduciaries and this data, you know, or the consent manager. And then my input would get sort of fed in into all the relevant, you know, relevant apps. I think that's the way I'm visualizing it. And as you rightly said, there was a concept being discussed on the dashboard, or, you know, or there is a possibility the other way around to say, these are my consents that I have given, nothing more, right? So for example, if somebody wants to take information from me, it is a no from me. And then that app is can say, hey, if it is a no from you, I will not provide service to you, which they can in their, you know, which is validly valid refusal, right? So I think that is what I feel is more like a gatekeeper, but it's going to be an interesting development to see, and new businesses will definitely evolve on this point.
Okay, thank you.
And the second question, who wants to take it? Yeah, what was the second question?
The second question was on data localization.
Oh, localization. So I think on the data localization, when we say localization, it's essentially, if I understand your question correctly, whether you will need to store in India mandatorily, right? I think that is the way to look at it. So the critical data you will have to store in India mandatorily. When I say store, not only store, but the processing aspect as well. So you can't even process critical data outside. And what is that critical data is yet not defined. When it comes to sensitive data, you can process outside or you can store outside, but you need to have a copy of that in India mandatorily. That is the real requirement from a localization perspective. Other than that, there is nothing more. Does that answer your question?
Yes, but if you allow me, I want to just ask another question with respect to data localization.
Sure.
Yeah, so when you say critical data or the sensitive data should be processed and the copy should be there within Indian territory or Indian boundary, right?
Right.
In this context, then let's say you ask any hosting service like AWS, Google Cloud Platform, or the Azure, or maybe the any third-party services like Slack. Slack is almost like everybody is using across organization. Then in that case also, maybe any organization may be processing or using the user's personal information or passing the personal information. But I'm sure their data servers are not within the India. So that's right.
So what all of these guys, and to our knowledge, most of the guys in the context of in anticipation of localization have already begun to sort of enhance their, you know, local capacity. And what will happen is when you enter into a contract with these guys, you will need to sort of ensure, or as a service, service in your agreements, that mandatorily to say that, hey, you should have servers in India to store a copy in India, only then I will, you know, sort of onboard you as my service provider. I think that's the way it will need to happen, or you will have to make an independent sort of arrangement with local cloud service providers or data center providers, where you ensure that a copy of that such data, which is say on a cloud with the in the foreign servers, is mandatorily maintained in India. It can work either way.
Thank you.
And many of the global cloud providers have already built in off-the-shelf localization option in different countries where they expect people might want to store data locally. So that can be selected without any customized negotiation as well.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Before we take the next question, a reminder to participants that you may press star and 1 to join the question queue. The next question is from the line of Aditya Bhandari from Z Associates. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. So my question is basically what So we just discussed about that, that there has to be a copy of data to be stored in India in terms of processing the sensitive personal data. But I believe that so since the new draft has been proposed, and I believe that the requirement of having a serving copy to be stored in India has been done away with. So if I'm not wrong, then wouldn't be a conflict as to data storage localization requirement in terms of that?
So see, what has happened is there was a requirement for all the personal data for being stored in India. That has been done away with. You're right about that. But insofar as sensitive personal data is concerned, if you just see section 33.1, insofar as sensitive personal data is concerned, a requirement to store a copy in India still continues.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Participants who wish to ask questions can press star and one. There are no further questions in queue.
Thank you, all the participants. And as I said, it's a very sort of extensive subject. So feel free to ask us further questions over email should you have any. And once you have seen our hotline, again, you may have certain further clarity on what we discussed today and some more points which we were not able to cover due to time constraint, but happy to sort of deal with them, over a conversation at any point in time. Thank you all the panel members and all the support staff who has helped us to, set this up. And have a good evening for all of you, and catch you on some other webinar soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. On behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. You may now disconnect your lines.